Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, we have a full report on Pope Benedict's ongoing pastoral visit to Cyprus, the first ever papal visit to the island. We hear from our correspondent travelling with the Pope there and learn more about the island's main political and social issues from the director of the Cyprus Research Centre. We also speak to Cardinal Foley, Grand Master of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre, who looks ahead to the upcoming Synod of Bishops on the Middle East, whose working document will be formally presented by the Pope at a Mass on Sunday in Nicosia. As we go on the air, Pope Benedict is nearing the end of the second day of his visit to Cyprus, the first ever by a Pope to this Mediterranean island, which has been divided for over 35 years into two parts. The southern two-thirds is inhabited by the Greek Cypriots and the northern third by Turkish Cypriots. Pope Benedict had a busy morning in the capital, Nicosia, where his engagements included a meeting with the President of the Republic, an address to the island's civil authorities and diplomats, and an encounter with the Catholic community. Our correspondent in Cyprus for this papal visit is Charles Collins, and he now tells us in detail about each of those engagements.
After arriving in the coastal city of Paphos on Friday, Pope Benedict spent his first full day in the capital, Nicosia, on Saturday. The day began with a courtesy visit to the president of Cyprus, Dimitris Christofias. During his visit, the president said the country was experiencing the painful military occupation of more than 36% of its territory, with Nicosia remaining the last divided European capital. He recalled the prayer for peace the Pope made in the Holy Land, which is also divided by walls, and asked this prayer for peace soon be fulfilled in the case of Cyprus as well. The president said he was seeking a just, viable, and functional solution to the Cyprus problem, with a goal of a bizonal, bicommunal federation with political equality for the two communities. The Pope then enjoyed a performance by the Cyprus Young String Soloists, before speaking about the importance of integrity in public service to a group of civil authorities and diplomats gathered at the presidential palace.
At a personal level, you, as public servants, know the importance of truth, integrity, and respect in your relationships with others. Personal relationships are often the first steps towards building trust and, in due course, solid bonds of friendship between individuals, peoples, and nations. This is an essential part of your role, both as politicians and diplomats.
The Pope urged governments to enact laws in accordance to the principle of natural law.
An appeal to the letter was once considered self-evident, but the tide of positivism in the contemporary legal theory requires the restatement of this important action. Individuals, communities, and states, without guidance from objectively moral truths, would become selfish and unscrupulous, and the world a more dangerous place to live. On the other hand, by being respectful of the rights of persons and peoples, we protect and promote human dignity. When the policies we support are enacted in harmony with the natural law, proper to our common humanity, then our actions become more sound and conducive to an environment of understanding, justice, and peace.
After his meeting with the civil authorities, the Pope went to the Maronite School of St. Maron. There, in the school's athletic grounds, he met with the Catholic community of Cyprus. Most of the Catholics are Maronites who arrived on the island in the 12th century, and Pope Benedict was welcomed by their Archbishop, Joseph Suwaif.
These are the values of the island: multiculturalism and dialogue of life, despite the difficulties of some periods from which we must take lessons. The choice must be openness and dialogue, respecting the particularities and based on love in truth. Thus, you will come to know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Welcome, Your Holiness. Thank you for being with us. May you bless your church and all the people of Cyprus who are glad of your presence.
The Pope made a special appeal to the small church on the island, saying they are in a unique position to benefit all of Cypriot society.
Dear brothers and sisters, given your unique circumstances, I would also like to draw your attention to an essential part of our church's life and mission, namely the search for greater unity in charity with other Christians and dialogue with those who are not Christians.
The meeting with the Pope was a celebration of Maronite culture with songs and dancing. The majority of the Maronites are from villages currently under Turkish occupation. Pope Benedict had special words for these displaced people.
In a special way, I wish to consign this message to those present who come from Kormakiti, Asomatos, Karpasha, and Aya Marina. I know of your desires and sufferings, and so I ask you to carry my blessing, my closeness, and my affection to all who come from your villages. We Christians are a people of hope. For my part, I fervently hope and pray that with the commitment and goodwill of those concerned, a better life for all the inhabitants of the island will be speedily assured.
After this meeting, the Pope went to the residence of the Orthodox Archbishop of Cyprus, Chrysostomus II. During his visit, he viewed the small cathedral of Nicosia, as well as the Museum of Icons, which includes ancient works looted from churches in the Turkish-occupied north of the country, which were returned to Cyprus from other countries. In his speech to the Archbishop, the Pope remarked on the role Cyprus has played in the dialogue between the Catholic and Orthodox churches.
I am likewise grateful for the support that the Church of Cyprus, through the clarity and openness of her contributions, has always given to the work of the dialogue. May the Holy Spirit guide and confirm this great ecclesial undertaking, which aims at restoring full and visible communion between the churches of East and West, a communion to be lived in fidelity to the Gospel and the Apostolic tradition, esteem for the legitimate traditions of East and West, and openness to the diversity of gifts by which the Spirit builds up the Church in unity, holiness, and peace.
The Pope also urged all the Christians of Cyprus to work and pray for peace, reconciliation, and stability throughout the Holy Land. With the Pope in Nicosia, Cyprus, I'm Charles Collins.
Let's step back for a minute and find out more about Cyprus, a Mediterranean island which acts as a bridge between the Middle East and Europe, and which is hosting a papal visit for the first time in its history. Cyprus has been divided since 1974, when Turkey invaded the north after a military coup by supporters of union with Greece. Turkish Cypriots declared an independent republic in the north in 1983, but only Turkey recognises it and maintains around 35,000 troops there. A so-called green line dividing the two parts of Cyprus is patrolled by UN troops. The Pope's visit to Cyprus comes just days after the leaders of the island's two rival communities resumed peace talks after a two-month pause. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon has urged the rival leaders to ensure that the reunification talks do not fall apart, warning that time is working against them. But what are the main sticking points in the reunification talks between Cyprus's Greek and Turkish communities? To find out more about the background to the continuing division of this island, I spoke to Dr. Christos Yakovou, director of the Cyprus Research Center, just as the papal visit got underway.
The most important issue for the Greek-Cypriot side regarding the ongoing negotiations or peace talks has to do with the effort of the Greek-Cypriot community to submit proposals for finding a solution based on a federal system, whereas the Turkish-Cypriot side submits proposals that promote the confederal system. So there are a lot of differences regarding the character and the nature of the future state that will emerge through these negotiations. And this has been in the agenda of the negotiations, of the bicommunal communications, since 1977, when the leaders of both sides decided to find a solution based on a federal system. But ever since, they never agreed upon the character and the final product of this model of solution.
The UN Secretary General warned that time was running out for this whole process. I mean, how high are the stakes? What would happen if these round of talks should fail?
Well, based on the experience of 2004, when the United Nations submitted a plan that was rejected by the Greek Cypriot side based actually on security concerns, I have to say that it will be disastrous if this new effort embarked upon by the Secretary General of the United Nations failed. But here we have to mention that following the election of a new leadership among the Turkish Cypriot side, the new leader, Mr. Eroglu, who is completely different than the previous one, Mr. Talat, made some statements that do not give a lot of room for hope. Like, for example, he is not bound in the agreements or the points the previous Turkish Cypriot leader agreed. So based on these points, I feel I must say that there are not a lot of hopes regarding the process. So I don't think and I don't expect that this round of negotiations will come to an end. When I say an end, I mean the United Nations will not ready to submit a plan that will be agreed by both sides for a new referendum.
And how much bitterness is there still between the two rival Cypriot communities? I mean, for instance, how much contact is there on a day-to-day basis between the two communities?
Well, following the developments of 2003, when the Turkish side decided to open the passages from one side to another, the contact between the two communities is on a daily basis, but it doesn't say anything, because the basic and the prime issues that prevent the peaceful outcome, that prevent the solution, still remain on the agenda of the negotiations. Like, for example, as I said before, the character of the system, the model for a permanent solution. There are issues regarding the refugee problem, the Greek refugees. There is a serious problem with the properties of the refugees who left, the Greek refugees who left the northern part of Cyprus in 1974. And several other issues that are of prime concern of the Greek-Cypriot side. So although there is contact between the two communities on the level of the societies, there is too much gap regarding the main political issues that prevent the peaceful solution or the submission of a new plan for a permanent solution in the question.
But, I mean, are there friendships that go across the divide? I mean, for instance, do you have any Turkish Cypriot friends or acquaintances?
Well, of course, there are. After 2003, a lot of Turkish Cypriots acquired the citizenship of the Republic of Cyprus. There are Turkish Cypriots who work in the area that is controlled by the Republic of Cyprus. There are Turkish Cypriots who live among Greeks. So the contact between the two communities, as I said before, on the level of the society, I mean, it goes very well. But the main problem is the political. So it's a kind of contradiction. Although there is contact between the two communities, there is too much gap regarding the bridging of the prime political issues.
But how does the continuing division impact on daily life in the island? Can you give me any concrete examples of that?
Well, The division is actually, the division has a reflection on the Greek side, because following the Turkish invasion in 1974, about 200,000 Greek Cypriot refugees left and moved in the south, where it is under the control of the Republic of Cyprus. The main problem is that although there is contact, those people cannot return to their homes, cannot claim their property, cannot use their property. So this is the problem on a daily basis. They can go to the north, but they cannot use their homes, their houses, they cannot use their properties, they cannot stay there. And this is a serious problem for them.
Apart from the reunification issue, what are some of the most pressing political and socio-economic issues in Cyprus?
Well, nowadays, the most important economic issue is the repercussions of the international economic crisis on the island. Although the crisis cannot push Cyprus very far, the crisis is started becoming obvious on various aspects on a daily basis. There are some other basic social problems actually derived from the fact of illegal immigration. And Cyprus is a small state, a small island, which is surrounded by a number of Muslim states. And illegal immigration, especially after Cyprus had become full member of the European Union in 2004, has become very intense. And the problem of illegal immigration creates a chain of other problems that can be traced on a social level. Actually, the case of Cyprus is similar on this level, on this issue, is very similar to the case of Malta. Two small states, Christian states, close to Muslim states, face illegal immigration that poses severe problems on a social and economic basis.
So are you saying there's quite a lot of hostility towards these migrants?
I don't say hostility, but I'm afraid there is a growing concern among the society that the number of illegal immigrants in Cyprus is growing. And up to this point, the reaction is to raise political demands to the state, to exert pressure on the state to step up tough measures regarding the protection of the borders of Cyprus and in the borders of the European Union. But I'm afraid if the governments fail to take effective measures, then there will be a more serious problem in the future regarding the reaction of the society.
And where do these migrants mostly come from?
Well, most of them come from neighboring Middle Eastern states like Syria, Iraq, Iran, Kurds from Turkey, and quite recently there are migrants from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and those countries.
But what was the mood and expectations among the Greek Cypriots in the run-up to the Pope's arrival on the island? Dr. Iakovou again.
The visit by Pope Benedict to Cyprus is the first ever by any pope in the entire history of the Catholic Church. And the visit comes amid a range of sensitive issues, including, for example, the Vatican relations with Orthodox Christianity and the vulnerable state of Christians throughout the Middle East, the Islamic Middle East. So people perceive the visit of the head of the Catholic Church in a very positive context. Additionally, we have to know that this Pope, especially this Pope, made some statements in the past regarding the effort of the Western world to protect, to stop the destruction of the Christian character of Cyprus following the Turkish invasion in 1974. More precisely, he was outspoken regarding the destruction of churches and the religious identity in the northern part of Cyprus. So people in Cyprus, the Greek Orthodox people of Cyprus, saw the Pope as an ally in their effort to stop this destruction. So they expected, they have great expectations from the visit of Pope in Cyprus.
And has there been a lot of coverage in the press about this visit?
Well, this is the most important issue. It has made banner headlines in the press, and it is the first new in the news coverage. that most of the press deals these days.
Do you believe that this visit by Pope Benedict to Cyprus will give a major boost to the ecumenical dialogue between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church?
Well, undoubtedly, the visit of Pope Benedict is a concrete move from the Catholic Church that the dialogue or the relations between the Vatican and the Orthodox Christianity must go on. This is something that is without doubt.
I was speaking to Dr. Christos Iakovou, director of the Cyprus Research Center. Pope Benedict's final scheduled engagement on Saturday was a mass being celebrated at the Church of the Holy Cross in Nicosia with priests, religious, deacons and Catholic ecclesial movements of Cyprus. The church and adjacent monastery, which houses the Apostolic Nunciature, is located in the UN-controlled buffer zone between the Greek and Turkish sides of the capital. It still bears the marks of bullets from the crossfire of ethnic strife and from the Turkish invasion of 1974. Father Umberto Barato is the parish priest and vicar general for Cyprus. He was once severely beaten by assailants who scaled the perimeter wall into the monastery. Father Umberto told us that he believes the church and monastery, located in a corner of the buffer zone with its armed guards, barbed wires and abandoned crumbling buildings, will make an impression on the Pope during his visit.
I think it is quite significant to come here for the Pope because we are inside the buffer zone, the green line, and it is quite significant for him to see also the surrounding edifices. They are in shambles. And the barbed wire that we have, I think it will make an impression to him. I think this is significant to see the condition in which we are. Now we don't have any problem with the other side, and so it's not a problem at all. But in the past, we had several problems. I was attacked one day. 6 years ago, he came to my room. I was attacked with an iron bar. They sent me to the hospital. So now it's impossible. Also because the Turks took notice and they did something in order to protect the place. Now, we put the alarm every day because the United Nations told us to put the alarm.
Although Catholics form only around 3% of the population in the Greek Cypriot side, their number has swelled in recent years as more and more migrants from the Philippines and Sri Lanka have arrived on the island. Father Umberto says the Sunday masses at his church are very popular. He puts the number of faithful attending the four masses on a Sunday at around 1,500, with many standing outside the church because there is no space. But does Father Umberto believe this papal visit will give a boost to the ecumenical dialogue between the Catholic and Orthodox churches?
Well, this is a step forward, I would say, but a real progress in the ecumenical, I don't think there will be, only to strengthen the friendship and the recognition of the two churches. Yes, you know, the ecumenical dialogue is very difficult. It's not only it is in the practical sense, but it's a theological sense. So it's a little difficult because we have many, I would say, many prejudices to overcome, still existing on both sides, but little by little. It is a work that doesn't belong to us. I would say that it belongs to God and to His providence and to the Holy Spirit.
That was Father Umberto Barato, priest at the Holy Cross Church in Nicosia. Sunday the 6th is the third and final day of Pope Benedict's visit to Cyprus, and its highlight is an open-air mass being celebrated at Nicosia's sports stadium. The Mass will be attended by bishops and clergy from throughout the Middle East, and during it the Pope will present the Instrumentum Laboris, or working document, for the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East, which is scheduled to take place in the Vatican this October. Following the Mass, the Pope will lunch with the bishops from the Middle East and the Orthodox Cypriot leader Archbishop Chrysostomos II. In the afternoon, the Pope's final engagement before flying back to Rome will be a visit to the Maronite Cathedral of Our Lady of Graces in Nicosia. But let's find out more about this upcoming Synod of Bishops for the Middle East and what is likely to be contained in the working document that is being presented at this Sunday Mass.
Among those travelling to Cyprus with the Pope, and who also will be taking part in the Synod, was Cardinal John Foley. The American Cardinal is Grand Master of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre, an equestrian order that provides support and aid to the Catholic Church and Catholic communities in the Holy Land, particularly as a way to stem the ongoing emigration of Christian families from the region. My colleague Chris Altieri caught up with Cardinal Foley just before he left for Cyprus and began by asking him more about the likely themes of the Synod's working document.
I'm looking forward to what this document will say. The previous document in preparation for the Synod was very rich, very good. And I hope that this visit and the Synod of Bishops will focus more attention on the Church in the Middle East, the sufferings it is enduring, the difficulties that it faces, but the wonderful and rich tradition which it has. Because there we have all of the people who are the descendants of those first followers of Jesus. And what a pity it would be to abandon them or to see them expelled or oppressed from or within the countries where they live. So I hope that this will be a rebirth of Christianity in the land of the Lord.
And the situation is dire. I mean, I was looking at this and have been for years now, that in 1910, the population of the areas under the custody and under the patriarch, somewhere between, you know, depending on exactly where you were, between 15% and 30% Christian. That's simply not the case anymore.
Not necessarily because of the departure of Christians, although many Christians have departed, but of an influx of new population, especially the Jews into Israel, of course. That was an enormous influx, and the increase of the population of Muslims. So while the number of Christians, while it hasn't remained exactly the same as it did, it has diminished somewhat, their percentage has diminished even more. So I guess now in the area of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, you'd be down to about 2%.
Earlier you mentioned education. A lot of the missionary work is being done for the Christians, but are the Christian populations there still contributing, punching above their weight, as it were, in the way that very often Christian minorities do in various places around the world?
Of course, because of the force of Christian education in those areas, you had the presence of Christians in government, in commerce, at a very important level. Now, even though the Christians are very highly educated, well educated, they don't have the opportunities they once had in Israel, and they don't have the opportunities they once had in the Palestinian area. And while they're respected in Jordan, they don't have the opportunities they might have there. So many decide to leave for lack of opportunity, and they're enabled to leave because of the excellent education they've had. So they don't have as much difficulty in getting access to other countries. So, for example, you have a very large Palestinian community in Chile. You have a very large Palestinian community in Detroit, Michigan. And you have a large Palestinian community in Australia. So the temptation is for those in the area of the Holy Land to leave to seek better opportunities elsewhere, since those opportunities don't seem to exist for them in the Holy Land itself.
That was Cardinal John Foley, Grand Master of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre, talking to Chris Altieri. And that's all we have time for today. I'm Susie Hodges, and from all of us here at the English Programme, we hope you've enjoyed listening to us. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet by going to www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.